Two environmental groups sue to stop a proposed copper mine near the Smith River. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has the surprising numbers for this past wolf hunting season. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with ecologist Laura Hansen about adapting to climate change. Two environmental groups are challenging the Department of Environmental Quality's decision to issue an exploration license for a proposed copper mine near the Smith River in central Montana. The Montana Environmental Information Center and Earthworks filed a lawsuit in district court in White Sulphur Springs on Friday. They argue the mining exploration proposed by Tintina Alaska Corporation threatens to degrade surface and groundwater quality and possibly decrease the amount of water running into the Smith River. In January, the DEQ approved an exploration permit that would allow Tintina to construct a mile-long tunnel to produce a 10,000-ton bulk sample of rock for testing. The lawsuit alleges the DEQ didn't adequately analyze the environmental impacts the exploration could cause to nearby Sheep Creek, a major tributary to the Smith River.
And in other news from around the state, west central Montana's high country is picking up significant moisture, most of it in the form of snow, and that could increase the avalanche danger. The West Central Montana Avalanche Center Steve Karkinen says the fresh snow is wet and heavy, which is adding lots of water weight to our existing snowpack, and that can produce avalanches.
We had moderating temperatures the last few days, which was helpful. We went through a pretty big avalanche cycle about a week or so ago, and things settled out pretty good, and we had some nice weather and went through some melt-freeze cycles, but now we're getting this heavy moisture again with high winds. Just a few minutes ago, looking at the wind speed on 0.6, it's already approaching 60 miles an hour out of the southwest west. You know, that alone, when we have a snowstorm, loads the leeward sides up pretty heavily, and we can produce avalanches easily with that kind of wind.
Karkinen urges anyone who plans to be in the backcountry in the near future to be extremely careful.
For folks here in the Missoula area, we'll be updating our avalanche backcountry advisory tomorrow morning, first thing. And just based on what I know already, we'll probably be bumping the avalanche danger up to considerable, which means that human-triggered avalanches are likely, and that people need to be careful about traveling, especially on steep wind-loaded terrain for the next few days.
He says the increased avalanche risk mostly applies to the backcountry and not to places like Missoula's Mount Jumbo, where an avalanche destroyed a home and buried three people last month. One woman eventually died of her injuries.
We're almost down to bare grass on Mount Jumbo right now, so there's really not much risk of anything coming off Mount Jumbo at this point in time. It's gone through several days of meltdown, basically, and there are still some pockets where there's, you know, some snow on the ground up there, but, you know, Mount Jumbo is currently closed anyway, and we're certainly not concerned about Mount Jumbo producing any avalanches at this point. I think the danger is past on Mount Jumbo.
Five Montanans and 18 other Americans have lost their lives in slides so far this winter.
It seems like we're right on track, unfortunately, with what we see every year, which is right around an average of 27 to 30 people who die in avalanches in the backcountry every year. What's been unusual this year is that most of those fatalities or most of the avalanche accidents have happened in the last 2 to 3 weeks, till end of February. We just have some very dangerous snowpack conditions in a pretty broad area around the western United States, particularly in the northern Rockies this year.
Visit MissoulaAvalanche.org for the latest on one central Montana's avalanche conditions.
Montana's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate fell to 5.3% in January, down 0.1% from December. Labor Commissioner Pam Busey says the state saw the addition of 1,600 private sector jobs and 200 public jobs in January. The leisure and hospitality sector led the way, adding 1,200 jobs. Including agricultural and self-employed workers, Montana added 1,906 jobs in January, marking the highest gain over a one-month period since July of 1983. Busey says recalculations using more complete data showed Montana's job growth for 2013 was 1.7%, which is faster than the state's historical average growth. But the recalculations also indicated Montana's unemployment rate in December was 5.4%, a bit higher than the 5.2% originally reported. The national unemployment rate was 6.6% in January. February's numbers are due out next week.
A bipartisan effort is underway in Congress to change the way the country pays to battle its most catastrophic wildfires. Lawmakers from Oregon and Idaho met with Interior Secretary Sally Jewell today to discuss the budget reform. President Barack Obama's proposed budget would prevent the diversion of money intended for forest thinning and other wildfire prevention efforts. Historically, as fire season progressed, money that had been set aside to thin forests and restore burned land was taken and used to pay for firefighting the biggest blazes. Legislation introduced in Congress would direct that when firefighting costs reach 70% of the last decade's yearly average, firefighting agencies could dip into the government's fund for battling natural disasters like hurricanes.
The final numbers for this wolf hunting season look to be very close to those from last year. The six-month season ended this past Saturday. Hunters and trappers killed a total of 230 wolves, compared with 225 last season. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the very similar numbers come despite more aggressive hunting rules from Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks.
This is the second year trappers have been added to the state's strategy to rein in wolf numbers, and trapping numbers actually dropped from 97 down to 86.
And that's a surprise to us that trappers took less wolves this year. Don't really know the reason. We would have expected with the additional licenses available that might have gone up.
That's Fish, Wildlife, and Parks spokesman Ron Ossheim. More licenses, that's just one of the ways the wolf season became more liberalized this time around.
Certainly the opportunity to take up to 5 wolves, each individual. Non-residents, their license price went from $350 to $50, Dan, and we saw a major increase. Last year we had 247 non-residents hunt wolves or buy licenses. This year, 10 times that many, 2,300.
So the fact that only a handful more wolves were killed this year, Ossheim says that goes to show wolves just remain a tough animal to hunt.
They're smartening up. There's been some pressure from hunters. There's been some pressure from wildlife services and our staff when we have depredating wolves. They're not going to continue to operate the way they do.
Ossheim says the agency continues to try to find a balance with the predator.
We know livestock depredation was down this year, which is really good news. We know that Montana's elk population, which is the primary prey base, is in healthy, really in good healthy condition throughout the state. We've got lots of elk in lots of places. We have 2 or 3 places where we know the predators, and in particular the wolf, is having an impact. That's the science here, or the art. How do we get to those areas and better manage wolves?
Last week, the Montana Fish and Wildlife Commission implemented a bill passed by the state legislature which allows landowners to shoot problem wolves on site without a wolf license. These could be wolves threatening people, pets, or livestock on private property.
Certainly it makes sense if you've got wolves that are a problem. You don't have to send out a government agent or somebody else to take care of the problem. And they understand there's some control. If it looks like it's getting out of hand, there's always an opportunity to go back and revisit that.
Last year, 75 wolves were removed by state and federal agencies and landowners for preying on livestock. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
A proposal from Montana officials would allow migrating bison into new areas of the state only if the animal's population was reduced below recent levels. The draft proposal is to be considered tomorrow by the State Board of Livestock. It would allow bison to roam year-round across more than 400,000 acres outside the park if the population numbers 3,300 or fewer animals. That last occurred in 2009. Restrictions on bison movements would increase based on a scale tied to population. Park biologists counted 4,600 Yellowstone bison last summer. Montana's livestock industry has opposed lifting bison movement restrictions over worries about disease and competition for grazing. Hunting and shipments of bison to slaughter removed more than 630 of the animals this winter under a year 2000 agreement between state and federal officials.
A Polson man who was struck in the head with a hammer nearly 2 weeks ago has died of his injuries. Lake County Undersheriff Dan Yonkin tells KERR-AM that 67-year-old John Barrows of Polson died at a Kalispell hospital on Saturday. The suspected assailant, 35-year-old Desmond Allen McKay, is scheduled to be arraigned in district court on Thursday on charges of attempted deliberate homicide and 2 counts of assault with a weapon for the March 5th attack. Prosecutors have said they would amend the charges if Barrows died. Court records say McKay called the name of another man, Jesse Waugh, and waited by the door to his garage. When it opened, McKay swung the hammer, which struck Barrows in the head. Prosecutors say McKay told investigators he hated Waugh and intended to hit him.
The superintendent, an elementary school principal, and a high school teacher have left Hart Butte Schools after a former student posted a threatening message on Facebook. School Board Chairman Grinnell Day Chief says Russ McKenna, Felicia Clevin, and her husband left before the board had a chance to respond. The board voted last week not to pay out the rest of their contracts. The Great Falls Tribune reports a student who was expelled from the school on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation in November put an expletive-laced post on Facebook on March 7th saying someone should get the white staffers out of the school before he got them out. Day Chief says law enforcement officers contacted the former student, who apologized and said he made the post in frustration.
A judge has dismissed a lawsuit against 10 online travel companies that Montana claims should pay hotel and car rental taxes. District Judge Kathy Seeley ruled March 6th that Montana law requires the hotels and car rental companies to collect and remit those taxes, and there is no tax burden on the online companies. Department of Revenue attorneys say the online companies, including Priceline, Expedia, Orbitz, and others, don't pay taxes on the full amount they collect from customers who book rooms and vehicles through them. The state argued the companies calculate taxes based on the rates customers pay to reserve rooms and cars, but the taxes actually paid by the hotels and car rental companies are based on the lower rates negotiated between them and the wholesale online brokers.
Land managers from Montana, Alberta, and British Columbia are gathering in Missoula this week to talk about managing the Crown of the Continent ecosystem for climate change. Participants include government agencies, nonprofit organizations, academics, and tribal representatives. The executive director of the Seattle-based nonprofit organization known as EcoAdapt, Laura Hansen, is one of the forum's featured speakers. Hansen is an ecologist who formed EcoAdapt 6 years ago to offer training and assistance for people learning how to adapt to climate change. In this feature interview, Hansen talks with News Director Sally Mock about her work and the climate change challenges ahead.
In 2008, there were very clearly two issues going on. One was that the amount of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere was increasing, and there was a large group of people working globally on what you do about that. And that area is called mitigation, key language for you. The other side of the equation was that we were already seeing the manifestations of climate change on the ground, and people needed to think about how do we change the way we do management and planning so that we're not planning for the past, but we're planning for the future. And I had been doing that internationally for almost a decade, and wasn't seeing enough of it happening in the United States. So I helped found an organization to try and address that problem.
It's key, isn't it, that this really is a two-pronged problem, that mitigation is important. And by mitigation means trying to keep it from getting worse.
Absolutely.
And then adapting to the changes that are already in place and evolving.
Yeah, both things have to happen together. You cannot adapt enough to respond to the kinds of effects we'll see if we don't stop reducing the amount of greenhouse gases.
Catastrophic effects.
Catastrophic effects that we don't even understand the ramifications of because we've never done the experiment while people were around to see what happens when you put that much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
So mitigation is crucial, but adaptation is something that I think is getting more and more attention, right? I mean, your group is fairly recent, but you're not the only ones out there obviously talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Adaptation is vitally important. Every day we make a host of decisions that are not only about today, but about the future. We build bridges. We design schools. We create 30-year plans for counties. All of that is currently being done, and historically has been done, based on current conditions. What we know is we won't have current conditions 30 years from now for those 30-year county plans. And we could be spending a lot of money and a lot of effort and making plans that essentially push us into what I refer to as decision cul-de-sacs. They don't give us the options of what potential futures we may face so that we can come up with better long-term outcomes.
When I talk to land managers these days, they're pretty freaked out, actually, because they always plan for 10, 20 years down the road based on historical data. I mean, what else have they got to go on? And now they're facing what is in some ways unpredictable.
Yeah. But the thing is that it's always been a little bit unpredictable. We've always made plans that were based on what
not
we thought
this much,
was
static. Though,
no,
right.
This is much more. But the fact is a lot of the tools that we have used to make plans that have allowed us to change as we go are still useful. But we have to be a little bit more proactive in how we use them. We have to realize that there will, in fact, be change and start thinking about what do we think are the most likely change scenarios. We're not going to know exactly what's going to happen. I can't tell you what 2100 will look like. The models show you generally. generally a trend.
And that's the issue, though.
But they don't tell you exactly what will happen. But in reality, we never knew exactly what was going to happen next season when we created a forest plan or a fisheries plan, because there could have been a catastrophic fire. There could have been a really cold winter. There could have been a drought. All of those things already put uncertainty into the equation. Now we just have to accept that uncertainty is inherent in the system, and it will go on forward. And we have to plan for uncertainty as part of our future.
You might make a certain plan that you think is going to adapt to what's coming along, but you have to be flexible.
Absolutely. And it's good to have ways to check along the way. So there have been examples of groups that have done planning exercises where they put in checkpoints and they say, let's see in 5 years or when this event happens, what we do. So there's a group in the San Francisco Bay Area, for example, that restored a set of salt ponds, settling ponds in the South San Francisco Bay Area. And they know that sea level rise is going to be affecting those that restoration effort. They don't know exactly when it's going to happen. So what they've done is they've built in some checkpoints, both in terms of time and events, to say when we see sea level rise this much or when it's been 5 years, we will check and see how the system's responding and will adjust it accordingly. But they're at the get-go saying, we know change is going to happen and we're building in checkpoints for change.
Another point you've made is, quote, we all live in a climate change zone. It's not like somebody's going to be exempt.
Exactly. It's a global problem. It's a global
problem. And a local problem.
It is a local problem and a global problem, and we all need to be thinking about it. What are its implications for ourselves as well as for our community? And that's actually an interesting challenge, is when you think about your own decisions. It's not, I want people to not just think about the decisions they make at work, although that's a great starting point. I want all the managers in the crowned region to be thinking about what does climate change mean for it, because they're sort of taking care of a public good for all of us, and I want them to make good decisions. But I'd love for everyone to be making it part of their own decisions. When people develop a new piece of property, are they planning for water availability there so that it's not going to become an abandoned piece of infrastructure in the future that then the community has to deal with?
Let's talk a little bit about specifics in terms of when you advise people about what they should be doing in a certain case. You have a system that you've developed for that advice. So say someone comes to you from Montana and they say, look, we're worried about the poor little pika. The poor little pika is going to disappear as the snow disappears, because it takes snow and higher elevations to survive the predators that prey on pika. So what do you tell me about how am I going to adapt the poor little pika so it can survive?
Yeah, so one of the nice things about the Crown region is that you've got a lot of things going for you. And it's always good to start with what are the things that one thinks they have going for them. The Crown region is very big. It is vast. You have a lot of space. It's not like you're a Pacific Island nation. You don't even live on a peninsula. You've got a lot of space going on. There's a lot of variability in that space as well. You have mountains. You have different rivers cutting different ways. You have northern and southern aspect slopes. You've got elevation. You've got all sorts of things to work with in developing a plan and designing what you're going to do. You also have a group of managers who are already thinking about this, which is fantastic. The strategy that we use starts out with five basic tenets, so five things that we want people to think about as a starting point. It starts with thinking about space. Do you have the right space for the pika? Will the pika be able to move up in elevation? Do the pika have a way to get to the next ridge that they need to be at? Can they take advantage of aspect so they're on the northern slope or southern slope? So what is that space and how can that be defined to protect it? The second thing is thinking about what are all the non-climate stressors that are acting on the system that are causing threat to the pika or whatever else it is you're looking at? And how do you reduce those in a significant manner so that climate change isn't exacerbating them? Because a lot of the things that we know are going on in the environment, when you add things like increasing temperature and decreasing precipitation, they become even worse. So things like environmental contaminants are known to become more toxic when you apply those things, or species become more sensitive. The third thing is incorporating uncertainty. So there's uncertainty with the pika story. There's actually some examples of pika populations that we thought would be doing very badly that are doing a little bit better than we thought. And we need to figure out why that is and how can we take advantage of that. How do we plan for the range of future scenarios that may take place in pika habitat? How do we plan for increasing precipitation in a short-term period but decreasing long-term precipitation? How do you take into both of those into account? How do you take overall warmer winters but less snow, meaning there's less insulation for pika in their den, and warmer summers, which are bad for pika? How do you think about all that uncertainty and make sure you're taking choices that sort of harness the range of it? The next thing is you can do some things to reduce the local rate and extent of climate change. It is a global problem. We are changing the climate globally, but there are things that you can do on a quite local level that can ameliorate it a little bit. So one thing is, in riparian zones, maintaining riparian vegetation can actually keep stream temperatures lower. Taking advantage of ways to harness and protect snow so that it doesn't melt as quickly can be done. That could, in fact, end up helping pike out. And then the fifth thing is, we really need to reduce the rate and extent of global climate change, because we need to get a handle on that if we want to protect things as we like them in perpetuity. And that's part of the game here, is there's going to be a lot of change. We have to figure out what level of change can we live with, and what are the things that we can't accept change in.
There are two things you don't want people to do, and one is to pretend it's not happening.
Exactly.
And the other is to panic that it's happening and throw up your arms and say there's nothing we can do.
There is so much we can do. If you want to think about things in terms of the long term, can we protect the Earth forever? Talk to a geologist who will tell you that that's a hopeless cause anyway. But there's, in terms of our lifetimes and our children's lifetimes, there is an array of stuff that we could be starting to do that could get us better long-term outcomes. But there is actually some warning here that if we don't start making better decisions, we will make things even worse. Our development and our planning can provide us worse long-term outcomes in the face of climate change than other activities that we could do. But we do need to be working on both mitigation and adaptation, and we need to be doing something. Pretending it's not going on and continuing to do things the way we have done them is probably the worst decision we could make.
Well, I've been speaking with Laura Hansen. She's executive director of the Seattle-based organization called EcoAdapt, and she's in Missoula to address the Crown of the Continent Forum. Laura, thanks very much.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Crown of the Continent Forum runs tonight through Wednesday at the Doubletree Hotel in the University Center and of the University of Montana campus in Missoula.
Now for today's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until midnight tonight for the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains and the Butte Blackfoot region. Tonight, look for mostly cloudy skies with scattered snow showers and lows 19 to 26 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with isolated snow and highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for all of central Montana. There's also a winter storm warning in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for elevations above 5,000 feet for the Rocky Mountain Front, Cascade County, central and southern Lewis and Clark, Judith Basin, and Marr counties. Tonight, expect snow showers and lows in the 20s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow through the day, and highs should be 35 to 45 degrees. In southwest Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for Madison, Jefferson, Broadwater, and Gallatin counties. Tonight, snow showers are likely with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow through the day and highs in the 30s.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 37 degrees with cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's cloudy and 39 degrees. Butte has 30 degrees under snowy skies, and Great Falls is cloudy with 34 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under light rain and cloudy skies is 41 degrees. It's 37 degrees and cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's cloudy and 40 degrees. Libby has 44 degrees with cloudy conditions, and in Polson, it's raining and snowing, and it's 37 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Bruce Farling.
In the words of Charles Darwin, history repeats itself. That's one of the things that's wrong with history. The eminent scientist could have been talking about Montana's codependent relationship with the hard rock mining industry. When entertaining mining, we continue to repeat history. We welcome it over and over, and we usually get burned. A small minority benefit for a short period, but all Montanans, as well as taxpayers elsewhere, end up paying for long-term cleanup, pollution control, lost water sources, and damaged fish and wildlife values, long after the last bucket of ore has been removed. That is our irrefutable history. Currently, an obscure Canadian company called Tintina Resources is proposing a large underground copper mine in a key headwater tributary of the storied Smith River, a venture that poses serious risks for water quality, stream flows, wild trout, and wildlife, to say nothing of how this in turn affects one of the premier recreational floating experiences in the West. Modern society needs mining, and yes, we will always have some mining in Montana, but the world is full of copper reserves. There is no need to risk special places like the Smith to produce copper for goods made in Asia. Predictably, Tintina, which recently received the okay from Montana's Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, to expand its exploration in the Upper Smith Country, says it will employ state-of-the-art environmental protections at the venture, and that environmental damages are artifacts of ancient history, if only. The company has hired influential locals to take this message to residents in Marr County, and trusting locals are buying it. Of course, this is the same pitch and same type of messenger the industry has employed for decades when seeking a new mine. Regulators often echo the message, adding that we shouldn't blame them for decisions that were made in the long-ago past when mining wasn't as regulated. But they are wrong. It wasn't that long ago. In fact, some of the same people reviewing Tintina's proposals helped permit fast-failed projects. Montanans were told gold mines at Zortman-Landusky, modern mines, would be beneficial and not produce horrific acidic pollution. Taxpayers are now footing a multi-million-dollar bill to treat pollution there in perpetuity. We were told the existing gold and sunlight mine near Whitehall wouldn't produce pollutants and certainly not acidic discharges that would last forever. But now it's clear that once the mine is closed, society will have to deal with pollution from there forever. Ranchers near Lewistown, whose water sources were interrupted by the Kendall mine, built not many years ago, were originally told the mine wouldn't harm them, but it did. Now, a long period after the mine was shuttered, the DEQ still hasn't forced the company to complete required reclamation. In the early 1990s, DEQ told the public, "Don't worry, the proposed Beal Mountain gold mine near Anaconda was state-of-the-art. It will be benign." Today, after mine abandonment, DEQ has handed the landowner, the U.S. Forest Service, a complex, multi-million-dollar cleanup and pollution control challenge. Much like at other mining ventures, the state didn't anticipate problems there, and it didn't, as is custom, require the company to post an adequate reclamation bond to cover long-term damages. It isn't that our state mining regulators are bad people, or that they are incompetent or don't care. Actually, they're nice folks. But years of political pressure from the industry and its legislative patrons have created a sense of mission at the agency that appears to be more about approving mining than protecting the environment, which is its core job. No amount of assurances from TINA or the State Environmental Agency can guarantee significant problems from mining will not occur in the Smith watershed. The record simply doesn't back them. And yes, Tintina could create jobs, but few mining jobs will go to Marr County residents. Instead, miners will flock there from other regions. Unlike local ranch kids, they have the technical experience in underground mining. Sure, the county's tax base could increase, but it must in order to offset the increased cost mining-related growth will incur on schools, law enforcement, road infrastructure, and social services. At best, tax production will be a zero-sum situation. More likely, it will mirror the Bakken oil patch, where funding for government services is being overwhelmed by explosive growth. Approving a large mine in the Upper Smith River drainage will inarguably provide another example of Montana's unfortunate blind codependency on things that produce some good, but much more harm. This is Bruce Farling of Montana Trout Unlimited. Contact us at www.montanatu.org.
Bruce Farling is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.